This is an interview with Congressman Mike Oxley for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is March 9th, 2012. We're talking at the Congressman's office at Baker Hostetler in Washington, D.C. Congressman, it's great to talk to you today.
Thank you, James.
Well, to start off, tell me a little bit about the years before you came to Congress. Did you have much experience dealing with finance or securities?
Well, no, really, I didn't. I graduated from law school at Ohio State in 69, and then I was recruited by the FBI, and I went in the Bureau, and but I did have some experience. I was on the bank robbery squad, so I investigated unauthorized withdrawals from banking institutions, and that was quite interesting. And then when I retired from the Bureau, I went back to my hometown, Findlay, Ohio, and joined my dad's law practice. But I really never had that much experience in the overall financial world, actually until I came to Congress.
Mm-hmm. At the FBI, did any of your training deal with finance or securities, or did you ever talk about insider trading or anything like that?
Not really, no. That was, back in those days, it was pretty much, stolen cars, bank robberies, bread and butter kind of things, kidnapping, that kind of thing that were federal laws, but not really much in the way of financial. The world has changed dramatically, mm-hmm. but that was 1969 through 71, so it was a whole different world.
Well, you were serving in the General Assembly in Ohio. Did you deal with issues like finance?
We had some issues. I was on the Judiciary Committee. We had some issues before us involving state bonding and that kind of thing, but again, not specific to that jurisdiction now.
Okay, tell me a little bit about how you came to join the House Committee on Energy and Commerce.
Well, I came in a special election in 1981, I was number 435 out of 435, so obviously I didn't have much of a choice on my committees. And I was really put on the Government Operations Committee, which is now, I guess, they call the Government Reform Committee. Indolent committee. I was very frustrated with the committee. But as luck would have it, by my second term, there were two senior Republicans on the Commerce Committee, Energy and Commerce Committee. One was Sam Devine, and he had gotten defeated back in the 1980 election, the only Republican nationwide that lost his seat. And then Bud Brown, the remaining Republican on the Energy and Commerce Committee, ran for governor in 82. And so it opened up at what we consider an Ohio seat, and I was, at that point, the logical choice to be on the Energy and Commerce Committee. So that's how I got on the Energy and Commerce Committee.
And you were also placed right away on the Subcommittee on Telecommunications, Consumer Protection, and Finance.
Right.
Yeah.
Which was a great subcommittee, maybe probably the best subcommittee in the entire Congress, House or Senate, mm-hmm. dealing with telecommunications issues, which were exploding back then, because you had a modified final judgment, dealing with the breakup of AT&T and Ma Bell, all of those, along with the securities issues as well. So it was a pretty exciting time.
Mm-hmm. I find that subtitles or the subcommittee's title interesting. So the same subcommittee that's charged with overseeing the nation's phone network is also in charge of financial regulation. Do you think that kind of suggests that there was somewhat less attention being paid to financial regulation at this time?
I think to some extent. What happened was John Dingell was chairman of the committee and a very acquisitive committee chairman who sought and got massive jurisdiction over many areas, using essentially the Commerce Clause to claim jurisdiction. And that's how I think in many ways that subcommittee came together with the rather disparate jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm. Now when you joined the committee, did you know much about the Securities and Exchange Commission?
Not really. I mean, I knew who they were. I knew something about it, obviously from law school, mm-hmm. but I didn't know a whole lot about the inner workings of the SEC by any means.
Did you do anything particular to sort of brief yourself on financial issues, or did
it just kind of evolved.
Right.
We had numerous hearings. We had various chairmen who were interested in those kind of issues. So, yeah, I think the first couple of years on the subcommittee were a learning curve for me. and a good one. That was, it was a practical learning experience.
Mm-hmm. At this time, many different people were concerned about different issues having to do with finance. One of the big issues was takeover tactics at this time, and I think the committee held hearings on the issue.
Over which?
Takeover tactics, mergers and
acquisitions. Well, yeah, and it was interesting because in late 81, well, after I had been elected, in the fall, Mobil announced a takeover, a hostile takeover of Marathon Oil Company, which is in my hometown, the largest employer mm-hmm. In my hometown. And that was a real baptism by fire, because Mobil presented a serious threat about taking Marathon over and moving all of their offices to New York City from mm-hmm. Findlay, which had been a devastating effect on my home town and my district. And of course, here I was in Congress about 3 months, and this whole thing comes up. So yeah, so I learned a lot, and we had hearings.
Was this something that you heard about from constituents?
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, it was World War III headlines in the Findlay Courier, the local newspaper, for a long time, mm-hmm. and we had one of these man bites dog stories where we actually had a rally in support of an oil company, it was a big deal, mm-hmm. and we were able to fend them off long enough that U.S. Steel came in as a white knight and bought Marathon, and ironically, many years later now, they were part of U.S. Steel. Then they became a tracking stock. Then they went out on their own independently, and now they're a separate entity traded on the New York Stock Exchange. So all's well that ends well, but those are some trying times, particularly for a new member trying to avoid total catastrophe in his hometown.
Right. Now, Congress had also been begun to take steps towards working on issues like insider trading. At this time, in 85 and 86, cases involving Drexel Burnham and Bosky Levine, Michael Milken begin to come to the front. How did these issues look from the perspective of Congress?
Well, I mean, this was a front, really, to everything that we thought was normal. And so we had a number of hearings. We had a very aggressive stance, not only with the subcommittee, but the oversight subcommittee that Dingell took a real interest in. And so that was a front and center issue for the committee for quite some time. Several trips to New York, briefings. I was immersed, really, in those issues. Learned, again, an awful lot, I think helped kind of set the stage for some changes in the laws and certainly in the regulatory structure.
Mm-hmm. There were several laws passed during this period. The first one was in 1984, the Insider Trading Act. Do you recall working on that at all?
I do. And I think at the time, Tim Wirth was the chairman of the subcommittee, if I'm not mistaken, from Colorado. We had Tim really did a pretty decent job on it, handling some of the really tricky issues going forward, and I think the changes we made have stood the test of time.
Mm-hmm. And then in 1988, there was also the Insider Trading and Sanctions Fraud Enforcement Act that was passed. I'm not sure if Tim Wirth was there during 84 or 88. I'll have to look that one up.
Oh, sure, he was there in 84. He went to the Senate then later, but I can't remember the timing of it. It might have been Ed Markey by the time it was 88.
Mm-hmm. In terms of drafting these different pieces of legislation, was this something that was mostly done at the staff level, or were you involved in drafting the language of it too?
No, most of it was done by the staff level. I think we were kind of trying to take a look at the issue from 30,000 feet, I think, because a lot of people, myself included, really were probably naive or unaware that insider trading was going on at such a mm-hmm. high level. And so it did kind of stripped bare all of this that was happening up there. And there were a lot of people in New York who were crying foul and saying that they were, but the evidence was pretty clear that there were some serious violations going on, and that it had damaged the real fabric of our system. And ultimately, I think there's a common thread that runs through all of these kind of scandals, was that somehow the game is rigged against the average investor, and that the perception of the average investor is that there's a game being played at a higher level that they're not involved in. And so what we found out in the hearings and subsequent scandals, whether it was Enron or the Great Recession, there was a common thread through that was kind of confirmed a lot of people's suspicions about how the game was played.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you heard a lot from constituents about the takeover tactics when it concerned people in your hometown of Findlay. Did you hear as much from constituents when these insider trading scandals were going on, or when there was the SNL crash in 1987? Was that something that was affecting people in your hometown?
Well, the SNL thing was, of course, we had a significant number of SNLs in my district, so yeah, that was... and at the same time, Ohio had its own kind of mini-problem with the SNL, so it was very much...
What was the mini-problem with the SNL?
Well, there was some state... became a political issue because there were some state officials that were involved in a mini SNL scandal in Ohio that basically cost the Republicans the governor's race and the legislature, almost presaging the later larger one nationwide. At the same time, the FDIC chairman was a classmate of mine in college and law school, Bill Isaac. And Bill was dealing with these issues at the FDIC along with Fizlik and the other regulars. So it was really, really quite an interesting time. But my point is the constituents were, I think, on the insider trading more of a skepticism about whether their investments really were being treated fairly as investors. And so the whole idea of investor confidence, I think, kind of permeates through this whole kind of a series of scandals.
You mentioned John Dingell's name a little bit earlier. He was committee chairman through most of these years. Did you have a good relationship with him?
I did. I had, matter of fact, Dingell, I probably voted with Dingell more than some of his Democrats, because we had similar districts, auto-related, energy-related, and Dingell was number one, a protector of the auto industry, and would fight against too many restrictions on clean air restrictions, that kind of thing, in the industry. So at that time, yeah, I would think I probably was part of that group of Republicans who actually voted more with Dingell than some of his liberal Democrats like Waxman and Markey and Tim Wirth and Al Gore, Barbara Murkowski, from Maryland. Anyway.
We'll look it up later.
Yeah.
Did you get to know any of the SEC commissioners during this period, like John Shadd?
Of course, yeah. Knew John, had frequent contacts with him. Breeden, mm-hmm. Shad, the professor, David Reuter. Yeah, all of those, and more.
Okay. Was most of your contact with them when you would have hearings and things like that, or did you all also meet privately to discuss issues?
Well, I know what several times we were invited over to the SEC for breakfast and a briefing. Mm-hmm. They had a very good, I thought, outreach program, mm-hmm. educational briefings for the members and staff.
Did you have any contact with Richard Breeden while he was working with the vice president?
Oh yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I had dinner with him a few times. Oh yeah, he was
okay.
Yeah, I still consider him a good friend.
Yep. Right. And then in 1996, this is jumping ahead a little bit. We'll go back and cover a few issues that happened in between. But in 1996, the subcommittee was split into two, a telecommunications committee and a finance subcommittee. What was the rationale behind that?
What year was that?
It was 96.
96. Well, that was the year after we took the majority.
Right. Uh-huh.
Trying to remember. Jack Fields had been chairman of telecommunications and finance, and then Jack retired, and I think I've got this right. Mm-hmm. Billy Tozan was a Democrat on the committee, switched parties somewhere in that period, and so there was a. They needed to take care of me and Tozan,
mm-hmm.
So they split the subcommittee. That's basically what happened.
Okay, then you ended up taking finance. Were you more interested in finance, or is that just how it happened?
It's just how it happened. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is one of those serendipity things that, you know, it's hard to explain.
Yeah, I think that's the way things work sometimes.
Yeah.
With Washington or wherever. So. Yeah.
Well, then I ended up with that was a. I ended up with finance and hazardous materials.
Hazardous materials.
Cash and trash.
Wow.
So I had all the finance, I had Wall Street, SEC, all that stuff. And then I had Superfund, toxic waste, all this kind of stuff. I mean, it couldn't have been two different.
No, they're both interesting in their own way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I understand that you were an early supporter of the move to require stock exchanges to post their prices in decimals.
Right.
Right. Well, what was your reasoning behind that?
Well, I did, you know, when I first became chairman of the subcommittee, one of my staffers, I brought him in. I said, what do you think? You know, what kind of any ideas about our agenda? And the first word out of his mouth was decimals. And I said, tell me more. And he said, well, yeah, frankly, the rest of the world trades in dollars and cents and lists stocks in dollars and cents. Why do we? So I did some study on it and found out it goes back to the Spanish doubloon, you know, in 1792 when the New York Stock Exchange started. The coin of the realm was the Spanish doubloon. Pieces of eight. So stocks were listed in pieces of eight, basically. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was rather odd, given the fact that the rest of the world had moved on.
But the stock exchanges seemed to like it that way.
They loved it because, and the traders loved it because their share was an eighth, was like, what, 33 or 36 cents or something?
Yeah, 13 cents or something like that, yeah.
So it was pretty attractive.
Right.
So I introduced this bill. I talked to Arthur Levitt.
Mm-hmm. He mentions this in his memoirs.
He what?
He talks about this in his memoirs.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what he says because Arthur was, he didn't want to make Wall Street mad, but he also wanted to see me do it. So he basically gave me his blessing sub rosa.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one commissioner on the SEC at the time who was his major function or major role, major goal was to have decimalization. Steve, can't think of his last name, bald guy. Anyway, he was the guy that Arthur kind of referred me to. I think he was a Republican, I think so. So I introduced this bill. Predictably, New York Stock Exchange was upset. So I went up to see Grasso, and Grasso made it very clear that they would oppose that, you know, right down the line. He had to protect his traders. Interestingly enough, though, NASDAQ was very supportive. NASDAQ got it. Their business model was different. The model fit well with, or the decimalization fit well with the NASDAQ model of an all-electronic market.
They were quite progressive at the time, moving towards an electric market.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they were very supportive. But Grasso was not. And so we had a hearing. And we had one of the guys that was supportive of it was a guy named Matt Andreessen. Do you know that name? Well, Matt was active in what we called ECN back then, Electronic Trading Network. And they testified, and they had a big penny, huge penny, and they showed the share that the trader would get under the old system and then the new system. Was quite graphic, quite interesting. Anyway, so Grasso, we invited Grasso to testify. And when I was up in New York with him, he, oh yeah, I'll come down and testify. Well, the day of the hearing shows up, and he sends his number two guy down. I knew we had him. And so we actually passed the bill out of subcommittee, I think unanimously. And at that point, the SEC saw the writing on the wall, so they then moved to go to decimals. And then the implementation turned out to be a little tougher than we thought.
It took a number of years, didn't it?
No, actually it didn't.
Uh-huh.
No, it took a matter of months, not years. And ironically, the NASDAQ had more difficulty adjusting than did New York for some reason. We finally got it worked out, and it went. And now everybody kind of takes it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
But we saved investors billions and billions of dollars over the years by narrowing that spread.
All those pennies add up, don't they?
Well, and now, and even back then, there were a lot of the traders that were lobbying for a minimum nickel tick. And there's still that going around that they want to... It's amazing, these people that are so adamantly free market to let the price fall where it is.
Want to set the game in a
certain
way.
Want to set the game, and, you know.
Right.
And it's really quite incredible that happened. And even today, after, 10, 11, 12 years, there's still that thought out there that somehow that we need a minimum tick for the lightly traded stock.
Now, another big issue that began to arise during the 1990s, probably even before 1996 when the committee was split up, was the issue of financial accounting in a variety of different forms. One of the issues was stock options that came up. Do you recall the Congress being very involved in that?
Well, I remember when I was chairman, we dealt with some issues on stock options.
On accounting for options and whether they should be included in the
oh, actually, yeah, okay. I was thinking of something that came up later.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the issue, yeah.
Now, was that something you heard a lot about from
I did. I mean, not from the average constituent, but yeah. From
it tended to be a bigger issue, I think, in districts that had large tech sectors.
Right, well, it was a FASB issue, right?
Right.
Yeah. I did. I heard from all the usual sources on that, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have much contact with the FASB during that time?
Yeah, I had my share. I think of the guy's name, Bob, chairman.
Mm-hmm.
There were two chairmen I dealt with. One, I can't remember the guy's. Anyway, yeah. The answer is yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Matter of fact, FASB was, the banking committee, mm-hmm. before I came over to finance, banking committee, I think Richard Baker had a number of hearings with FASB, mm-hmm. trying to keep FASB from doing that.
Right.
And that went on for quite some time. And the FASB chairman was named Ed, I think his first name. Right. But he used to regularly come in and just get the hell beat out of him by the banking committee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Congress was quite critical of the FASB during this period. Do you feel that some of these accounting issues, like stock options and derivatives and other things, did you see them as sort of arcane issues that should be left to the accountants, or did you think that Congress had a role to play?
Well, FASB has its role, but at the end of the day, Congress has to make the rules. I mean, nobody ever elected FASB to anything. So I think it's a natural give and take, a natural tension between FASB and the Congress. And I have no particular problem with that. Some of the things FASB did I approved of, some I didn't, but you know, that's how the system tends to work.
Right. Now, from the mid-1990s onwards, there were different attempts to pass a sort of sweeping financial reform bill, but it wasn't until 1999 that the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act actually passed, the Financial Services Modernization Act. Why do you think it took so many years to get it done?
Well, it took like 80 years.
Yeah.
Well, I think that... first of all, it's a lot harder to pass a bill than kill a bill. And so we passed one in the House the year before that by one or two votes. And it was John Boehner, now the Speaker, was assigned the role of kind of ramrodding this thing or being the quarterback on it. And at the time, I was subcommittee chairman. So we did get the bill passed, but it never went anywhere in the Senate. But it set the stage for what became Graham-Leach-Bliley. Part of the problem was the split jurisdiction. That's why Leach and Bliley are both on the bill, because Bliley was chairman of the Commerce Committee. Leach was chairman of the Banking Committee. So for years, you had this incredible tension and fight over jurisdiction. And nothing slows or kills things in Congress more than jurisdictional fights. So it was all inside baseball. So the proponents of change really couldn't do anything. That's why. And ultimately, that's why, at the end of the day, I ended up as chairman of the Financial Service Committee and took the jurisdiction over the banking. It made perfectly good sense from a structural standpoint, particularly after Graham-Leach-Bliley. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Right.
But that's really what happened then.
Kind of a key moment in that legislation was in 1998 when John Dingell agreed to support the bill. It seemed to have had mostly Republican support beforehand, and then when Dingell joined in, that changed it a little bit. What do you think changed his mind?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I mean, Dingell was, for example, on natural gas, he was always for regulation of natural gas at the wellhead. And he said, we're going to deregulate natural gas at the wellhead over my dead body. Well, we eventually did, but he was still alive. But I have no idea what changed his mind.
Right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the creation of the Financial Services Committee. You just mentioned a little bit about that, but what was the main incentive for creating that committee?
Well, there were two issues. One was substantive and jurisdictional. One was substantive, and one was political. And by that time, Tozan was chairman of the Commerce Committee. I was chairman of the. First of all, the Speaker, Hastert, agreed that after Graham-Leach-Bliley, we needed to graft the insurance and securities jurisdiction with the old banking committee. That was, from a substantive standpoint, that made perfect sense. It was also true that Jim Leach was the term-limited chairman of the banking committee. So Jim's last term was 2000, I guess. And then, and so it made sense at that point for me to move across the hall to banking committee, create a new financial services committee, which we did. And at the time, there was there were no obvious candidates to take over for Leach. And so it made a lot of sense politically to give me a chairmanship, give Tozan a chairmanship, and that's how it evolved.
Right. Now, the committee was rather large, I understand.
It was the second largest committee in the House. I think we had 71 members.
Yeah. Well, why such a large committee?
Well, partly because of for me bringing that jurisdiction with me, there were several members of the Commerce Committee that wanted to be basically on both committees. So the Speaker granted them a significant number of waivers, at least a half a dozen. Mm-hmm. But the Banking Committee had been fairly large anyway to start with. So it was the added jurisdiction brought with it that change. Plus, you know, you had a change. Well, I think that was the main reason. Mm-hmm. I was frankly surprised that we had 71 members, but that's the way it worked.
Now, I understand this committee was approved mostly along party lines. I think there was one Democrat that voted for the change in the committee. Do you think the objections on the other side were substantive, or was it more just a partisan vote?
On which vote?
Create this new committee on financial services.
Well, that was part of when the House, when we were sworn in that year, when the usual housekeeping amendments or resolutions passed.
Right.
I think, is that what you're referring to?
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. That was all about Dingell and losing jurisdiction.
Right.
But, you know, Dingell was no longer the chairman, and so, and Republicans were in control.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's how it works.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in terms of finance, the biggest event during 2000 was the Enron bankruptcy, the Enron collapse. How did that issue look from the perspective of Congress?
It was a huge issue, followed closely by WorldCom.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people forget WorldCom was four times larger than Enron,
mm-hmm.
and Enron was the seventh largest company in the country.
Yeah. Do you recall when you first heard about Enron?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And one thing that did surprise me was, at least at the time, how incendiary that issue became in the media. But looking back on it, it had everything. Fraud, deceit, greed. One guy committed suicide.
Juicy story, right?
Oh, it was just and this is really before the cable 24-hour news cycle, but it was just an Armageddon kind of stuff, and it just captured the public's imagination. You know, guys doing the perp walk, the bad guys, Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling and Andy Fastow.
Your committee called Kenneth Lay to testify several times, right? Understanding?
I don't think so.
No?
Okay.
Perhaps not.
Our committee had the first hearing on Enron, and that was in December of 2001. We had the CEO of Arthur Andersen,
mm-hmm.
who didn't know it at the time, but he had one foot in the grave and one on a banana peel.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 weeks later, he was cashiered. We had, analyst, Enron analyst.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we were the first to have the hearing. And and then, shortly after that hearing, Enron appointed the special committee to study what went wrong with Enron. led by Dean William Powers, who is the dean of the University of Texas Law School, who is now head of the Texas university system, and Bill McLucas, who had been the enforcement division chief at SEC and is now with Wilmer Keller. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, do you want me to get into that now?
Right, yeah, if you'd like to talk about it.
Because really, there is no question that the Powers report, and they testified to our committee exclusively, was the paradigm really for the legislation. We introduced the bill because they did a super job in determining what went wrong with Enron. Mm-hmm. And the takeaway from their testimony was that in every case, the so-called gatekeepers at Enron had failed. The accountants, the attorneys, analysts, the board, the credit rating agencies, in every case. And so we really crafted the bill we introduced in early 2002 then. It was called CARTA, Corporate Accountability, Responsibility, and Transparency Act. Mm-hmm. And
this was before the Senate bill was introduced.
Oh yeah, long before. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I'm not sure there ever was a Senate bill introduced. I can't remember, but the Senate really didn't really get active in this thing until WorldCom mm-hmm. broke. And we had pretty much finished our work by the time WorldCom hit. Excuse me, I'm just going to get some water.
So we were in the middle of talking about when the legislation was introduced to
right.
Congress. Do you recall the moment when you realized that there needed to be a legislative response to this problem?
Probably that first hearing. Mm-hmm. It was, and then certainly after the Powers report, because Powers, they came in, he and Bill came in to see me before they testified, a couple days before they testified, and went through granularly the whole process, and it was shocking, really, what they found. Heretofore, I had been somewhat skeptical of the whole thing.
You mean the need for legislation?
Yeah, I had been one to believe that, you know, corporate law to be determined by states. And, of course, the Delaware court agreed with me. But I changed my mind seeing what had occurred at Enron. And it was the fact that, you know, here you had people who had worked at Enron, who not only lost their job, but lost their life savings. Because most of these people had 401ks with virtually all Enron stock. And you see these interviews that are heartbreaking about these people that were just, mm-hmm. you know, just boom, all of a sudden they're gone. And everything that they owned is ever, you know, it's gone. Yeah. And they see their bosses going to jail, and it's just a horrible experience. So that was really what. It was just no, to me, there was no question. Plus the public outrage was something I had never seen.
So you were hearing a lot from constituents?
I was hearing a lot from constituents. I was hearing a lot from my colleagues. Mm-hmm. It would be, honest to God, I would be, almost every time I would go down to the floor during a series of votes, I would have members seek me out and tell me a horror story about an investor back in their district in Michigan and Illinois. Went on and on. I mean, it was just, I felt like I had to put on a disguise almost because I hear these stories. So this was a phenomenon that was driven by the public, obviously exacerbated by the media coverage, but I've never seen anything quite like. I would go home to my conservative, Republican, pro-business district, and the talk about CEOs was pretty much, let's give them a fair trial and then hang them. I mean, it was palpable. These were people that I've known for years. They were conservatives, investors, pro-business, pro-market, that were just had it up to here with what they were seeing and hearing.
So they knew that you were in the process of proposing sweeping legislation, and they still were supporting.
But it wasn't just me. I mean, again, all of my colleagues were hearing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Not just the committee members or myself as chairman, but just all over the country. Yeah. You had this total lack of investor confidence, just outrage about, what was happening to them. Because if you think about it, well, we had become a nation of investors in those 15 years that I was in Congress, for the first 15 years. That 15, 20 years, we became a nation of investors. 54% of American households own stock. 401ks were introduced, IRAs, online trading, and it was a big American success story. Mm-hmm. And I would venture to say that virtually everybody in the country owns stock in Enron and WorldCom. If you were a financial advisor and you didn't advise your client to have Enron or WorldCom in your portfolio, you could get sued for malpractice probably. So that's how pervasive that was. And so you can see why you'd have that kind of reaction.
No, that's perfectly understandable. Now, my understanding is that there was a House bill and a Senate bill, and then in the final weeks before it passed, there was some sort of the process of reconciliation.
Well, we had a conference committee.
Right. Uh-huh. Do you recall the major issues that were under discussion?
Yeah, let me say, first of all, we passed, the House bill passed 423-3. Now, there's a lot of revisionist history out there that bill was controversial. Really? Three negative votes? I don't think so. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of pressure from the White House to get that bill passed. President Bush came out with his 10 points about the time that we were in dealing with the bill in committee. I think we satisfied about 9.5 of those when we passed the House bill. The Senate was very deliberate. And then that's another thing people forget. The leadership of the Senate changed in that period. Jim Jeffords, who was no longer Republican, so Phil Graham, who had been chairman of the Committee of Jurisdiction Banking, was replaced by Paul Sarbanes. Big philosophical change. Mm-hmm. Big philosophical change. So, and then you had WorldCom. Just when you thought you'd had enough of Enron, WorldCom comes along. Bernie Ebers. We had a hearing on Enron, or on WorldCom. Bernie Ebers and Scott Sullivan both took the Fifth Amendment before my committee. The only time that ever happened to me in 6 years as chairman.
What was your reaction to that?
Not surprised.
Yeah.
Particularly in retrospect.
Right.
But so this was a became a huge deal. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the Senate was having these hearings. Mm-hmm. They had every living former SEC chairman there, and Paul did a really good job of kind of plodding through this thing. Mm-hmm. And I had never even met Sarbanes, and so they finally passed their bill. Mm-hmm. Again, controversial, 98-0. Right. Phil Graham voted for it. Barbara Boxer voted for it. Ted Kennedy voted for it. Richard Shelby voted for it. You get the drift.
Right.
Now, the day after the Senate passed their bill, the Business Roundtable, representing the Fortune 500 company, right? Mm-hmm. requested that the Senate bill go to the president directly and we not have a conference committee. And you can look that up. I was stunned and furious. What had happened was Hank Paulson, who was at the time was chairman of Goldman Sachs, gave a what was described as a mea culpa speech here at the National Press Club, basically apologizing for Enron and WorldCom and calling for strong legislation from the Congress. The business community was absolutely petrified of getting their sticking their head up on this issue because they were going to get it chopped off. Mm-hmm. The public outrage was so great. So they figured just, you know, stop the pain, get it over with, send a Senate bill. Well, the House bill was significantly different from the Senate. We were accused of having a weak bill. Mm-hmm. The press always wrote that Oxley's bill was weak and yet it's strong in the Senate. Well, then, of course, Enron came, or WorldCom came along and mm-hmm. Senate bill did move farther to the left, including some of the strongest, 404B was
right.
Probably the biggest example of that.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that obviously has been the most contentious part of the legislation and the most expensive mm-hmm. and the most criticized.
Right.
I make it a point to say we didn't have that in the House bill, it was in the Senate bill. Mm-hmm.
Was there much thought given to how much it was going to cost at the time?
No. Now the Senate did a windshield job on the cost, and it was not even close.
Right.
But even worse than that, the business community totally capitulated. Totally. Mm-hmm. Witness what the Business Roundtable suggested. The Chamber of Commerce was nowhere to be found. The Wall Street Journal, by the way, was nowhere to be found. In that context, and the fact that it passed virtually unanimously in both houses, and that the Business Roundtable wanted to go directly, I finally went to the Speaker and said, I don't want to hear about this. We were going to go regular order. And we actually had a conference, and I was chairman of the conference committee.
Okay.
But we made some changes in the conference mm-hmm. that were beneficial, I think, and made it a better bill, including the FAIR Fund to compensate victims that would take the money paid in fines and disgorgement and pay back shareholders, mm-hmm. which is what we did at Enron. Several billion dollars. So it was a very beneficial change in the law. Another one was Joe Biden had an amendment in the Senate floor that would require the chairman, the non-executive chairman of the board, to sign the financials along with the CEO and the CFO. Passed unanimously after about 10 minutes of debate.
Yeah.
The only pushback I got when I was chairman of the conference committee was from some CEOs, including some well-known CEOs, who called in opposition to that. And Sarbanes agreed with me, and he took the amendment out, which I thought was pretty courageous on Sarbanes' part, because he had a fellow chairman, who Biden was chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, but he took it out. And believe me, every senator who ever thought about running for president or ever thought about running for re-election had to have an amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So their amendments are flying over the transom right and left on the Senate floor, and a lot of them weren't very good policy.
Right.
And we were able to clean some of that up in the conference.
Yep. Now, in the conference committee or during the drafting of the legislation, was there much controversy over this idea of creating a new body, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board?
No. I think that was an agreed by both houses. Heretofore, the accounting industry had been self-policed. The abject failure of Arthur Andersen in those circumstances called for a paradigm change. Mm-hmm. And I think there was virtually no opposition to creation of the PCAOB.
Just to ask you about Anderson, did you expect that they would eventually go out of business after all this happened?
The big, people ask me what the biggest mistake was. The biggest mistake was the death penalty for Arthur Anderson. And that came right from the White House.
Yeah. It came from the White House.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Big mistake.
Reduced competition in the accounting.
Absolutely. Yeah. And part of the reason why you had this cost issue, when you think about it. You know, when I came to Congress in 81, there were the big eight accounting firms, right? Mm-hmm. Then you had the big five with consolidation, and all of a sudden you got the final four. Mm-hmm. And so it just is a matter of economics, it's just supply and demand. So all these companies that had Arthur Anderson had to go out and find a new accountant, right? Mm-hmm. Pretty fast. Cost them a lot of money. People forget that. People forget that PCAOB was under enormous pressure because we made them out of whole cloth, right? Mm-hmm. These are newbies. These guys come in, they've got to make some timely decisions on regulation, on 404 and the like.
Mm-hmm. Not all of them were accountants either.
No. But even if they had been, the pressure was so intense for them to be seen as punitive towards business. That's how 404B came into play, or at least the implementation of 404B, which again also had major implications on the cost. Mm-hmm. Most of the complaints about SOX is about 404B.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think to a large extent it was, and I think some folks at PCAOB looking back would probably agree with me.
Mm-hmm. If you could go back and rewrite this legislation, would what aspects would you change?
Well, I would not have passed 404B.
Mm-hmm. In that some, was maybe a major. Some revised form for big corporations or for
what's that?
What would you pass it in some revised form for larger corporations and then just exempted the smaller capital?
Well, I just think that I think 404B could have been handled. I think, for example, you don't have to have the total attestation take place every year. I think you for companies that are well managed and are following these, you only have to do it every 2 or 3 years, seems to me, which could save them a lot of money. You still have 404A, internal audit, but some of the reforms have worked, I think, exceptionally well on the audit committee, hiring the audit committee made up of independent board members, hiring the outside auditor eliminates that potential conflict of interest or, you know, back rubbing on the both sides with the CEO and the mm-hmm. and the accountant. So yeah, I think a lot of those have made it more transparent. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, SOX was about transparency and accountability. That was really what we made our mm-hmm. efforts at. And I think to a large extent the test really is whether you've had a recurrence. We've had nothing even close to an Enron or WorldCom. But people forget, we lost $8 trillion in market cap as a result of the Enron, WorldCom, and other scams. $8 trillion. Every investor, whether he was investing in Enron or WorldCom or not, lost money in that period. Go back and look. I just looked at my own personal 401k. 2002. It went down like 26%. 26%. Everybody, virtually everybody, can say the same thing. So for these, for the CEOs to complain about SOX, I ask them, what was your market cap on July 30th, 2002, which is the day the president signed it, and what is it now? You know, the idea to restore investor confidence, to get these people back in the market, takes a long time. And now you've had, basically within the last 10 years, you've had two major scandals that go directly at the heart of investor confidence. It's a miracle that the markets have come back as much as they have, given what the average investor has had to put up with over the last 10 years.
Yeah, that's a good point. I want to ask you about the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board just a little bit more. Now, the early years of this board's history were a little bit difficult. There was a conflict over who to appoint as the head of the agency for some time. Do you recall how that played out in Congress? I think there was a conflict over whether to appoint John Biggs or not.
Oh, that was mostly at the executive level.
Okay, that was not in the Congress then. Okay.
No, I don't recall, no.
Yeah. All right, I just wanted to ask you about a couple different issues over the course of the early 2000s that you might have had to have dealt with. One of those was deposit insurance reform. In 2006, the president finally signed the bill that instituted a deposit reform, but this had been a subject of discussion for a number of years. Right. Why did it take so long to get it passed?
I guess just I don't know. I mean,
yeah, inertia.
Yeah. Everybody. There's always somebody invested in the status quo, right?
Right.
I mean, frankly, we didn't. You know, we were going to increase the amount of the insurance. Mm-hmm. And the White House was against it, and so we punted on it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when it hit the fan, by that time, Barney Frank was the chairman, and Barney passed his bill, and guess what? It raised it to exactly what we had wanted to raise it before, right. But we couldn't get any traction on it.
Yeah. So it goes. Yeah. Another issue that the committee worked on during these years was mutual fund costs, the fees that mutual fund investors would pay. And in 2003, your committee held some hearings on the issue, and you invited John Bogle to speak. Yeah. Was this an issue that was important to you?
It wasn't to begin with, but it became one, yeah.
Yeah.
And Bogle hit a lot of raw nerves.
What do you mean by that, just for the listeners?
Well, I mean, in terms of the ICI and, mm-hmm. you know, because Jack was, I mean, the guy basically invented the damn process, you know, mutual fund. And so for him to speak of what was going on inside the tent, you know, put a lot of noses out of joint.
Mm-hmm.
But then, frankly, I thought he was a crank to begin with. But the more you looked into it, the more you found out that he knew what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry really did need some major revision.
So the committee came up with a proposal for a bill, the Mutual Funds Integrity and Fee Transparency Act. Did that end up passing?
A version of it did later, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But that was always not until you had some major scandals within the mutual fund industry.
Mm-hmm.
And they, at that time, when it became obvious that there were some real flaws in late trading and after-hours trading, that kind of thing, that they were weakened politically to the point where we could get legislation passed. And with that, at the end of the day, with their blessing, because they were having a PR nightmare when this came out. People were getting out of mutual funds. And again, another example of how insiders were getting a better benefit than the average investor.
Right. Now, what during these years, the early 2000s, was there much thought given to the possibility of increasing supervision over the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
Oh, yeah, well, I could do a whole hour on that.
Yeah, well, tell me a little bit about the
well, debate. I mean, Richard Baker from Louisiana was the lead dog on the effort to try to rein in Fannie and Freddie, because they had become essentially monstrosities. But Baker, when he was over at banking, could never really get to first base. He was kind of a one-trick pony, but he was really dedicated. Fannie and Freddie were so strong that it wasn't until I took over as chairman of financial services and I appointed Baker subcommittee chairman, having jurisdiction over GSEs,
mm-hmm.
capital markets GSEs. And so I told Richard, I said, look, you know, I'm not going to tilt the windmills here, but I said, at some point, if you can put together a coalition, we can get enough votes, we all go forward, GSE reform.
What specifically did you consider to be reform? What elements would that have entailed?
Transparency, given, basically, though, creating a world-class regulator that had the ability to limit their portfolio, limit their debt. That's really what we wanted, was because they were dealing with Ofeo, which was in the basement of HUD, didn't really have any clout to speak of. So we wanted a real, honest-to-God regulator that had some power, that was respected and feared by Fannie and Freddie. So I told Baker, I said, then Fannie got in some serious difficulty with the SEC. And the SEC said that their smoothing out their earnings was an absolute violation of the law and the regulations. So then the Warren Rudman Committee was appointed to look into this. And Rudman testified before our committee, and they did a hell of a job. And boy, they laid out Fannie like something I've never seen before. And so Fannie went from being 10 feet tall to being a midget, and that was a time to strike. So Baker did a great job at here. He had some other subsequent hearings, and we lined up, and we finally got a bill passed in 05 that was... It passed 3-1 in committee and 3-1 on the House floor, like 90 votes against it. And most of those against it was the Congressional Black Caucus, who was totally in the tank for Fannie and Freddie. And we also included reforms for the Federal Home Loan Banks as well. Bill had enormous support, passed, say, 3-1 in the House, 300-something to 90. Ironically, or just inexplicably, I guess, Greenspan was against it. The White House, or at least some people in the White House, were against it. And I couldn't for the life of me understand, for the first time ever, we had Fannie and Freddie on the run. We really did. And these guys essentially wanted a perfect bill. They wanted a bill that by law ratcheted down their portfolio to put it in the law. And I kept saying, look, that's why you need a world-class regulator. We are giving that regulator unprecedented power and authority to do this.
You don't need to specify the numbers in the bill.
It's just... And besides that, I couldn't pass it. I didn't have the votes to pass it. Politics is the art of the possible.
Right.
So we passed this bill. Shelby over in the Senate did a half-hearted attempt at a markup. It failed on a partisan vote, and that was the end of it. And the White House was glad, because the White House is out there urging these guys to buy mortgages, and at the same time, saying that they want to get rid of them. And they just didn't add up. And Ed Greenspan was on record as saying that my bill, he called me the morning of the markup and said, this bill is worse than no bill at all. I said, I just kind of could not get my head around it. It was a sad, sad case. So what happens? Fannie and Freddie explode. And 3 years later, Barney Frank passes essentially the same bill that I passed. We'd had 3 years. I think that that legislation, had it been enacted and we'd have had a world-class regulator, would have mitigated the damage that the economy went through in 08. I really do. Yeah. And it is unreported. You won't read about it in the Wall Street Journal. You won't read it. You won't hear anything about it from Greenspan. You certainly won't hear anything about it from the Bush White House. It's really sad. Somebody ought to do an in-depth analysis on that, because that was just beyond the pale. And if there's one disappointment I had in my 6 years as chairman, it's that fact that we couldn't deal with that problem. When everybody knew what the problem was, and everybody knew, I think, what we needed to do to solve it, and what we could politically could do to solve it. Not write a perfect bill in heaven, but to actually write a perfect bill that could get enough votes to pass the Congress and signed by the President. Drive me crazy.
Too bad that it sometimes takes a crisis. Right?
Oh, God. Yep. And then we lost another $8 or $9 trillion in market cap. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that the Congress is sometimes credited with during this period is helping to push banking regulators to agree to the Basel II capital requirements. Do you recall playing a role in that at all?
Well, we had a number of hearings on that. I think on a bipartisan basis, both Barney and I agreed that some of the proposals out there which were going to disadvantage American banks. Mm-hmm. And we made it pretty clear, and there was a big split among the regulators, U.S. regulators, about the efficacy of the proposals coming in from Basel. Okay. So that was one of those cases where you had a distinct difference between the Fed and the FDIC, for example. I think that was... That we played a very positive role, I think, in trying to get that so it wasn't as one-sided as some people thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Congressman, you served on the Hill for almost 3 decades, and you spent a lot of time working with the SEC. How much difference do you think that the personalities at the commission make in the relations with the Congress?
At the SEC?
Yeah.
Well, I think it all comes down to the chairman. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, and obviously they all have their own pluses and minuses, you know, and different personalities. I found every one of them to be intelligent and resourceful, full of integrity, transparent. Even when I disagree with them, I think that we've had... in my relationship over the years, I think I've had a good working relationship with SEC chairman and some individual commissioners as well.
I also wanted to ask you about cooperation on a bipartisan basis within these committees that work on financial services. Obviously, you've worked on a lot of them over the course of your career. Was it always easy to reach across to colleagues in the other party? Reach out to them, or did you find that the finance and financial issues were very divisive in partisan terms?
No, I don't think that, as generally speaking, those financial issues we took up in the committee were particularly partisan issues. Well, maybe with the exception of the GSEs, I think the GSEs were more R versus D kind of thing. But everything else. I kind of prided myself in getting bipartisan consensus. Virtually every major bill that I passed out of committee passed on large bipartisan majorities. If you can look back, I mean, it was quite extraordinary, and particularly the last 4 years when Barney Frank was the ranking member.
Did you two have a good relationship?
I had a good relationship with Barney. He's a very professional, loves the... He's an institutional kind of guy, wants to get things done, doesn't suffer fools gladly, always keeps his word. So we had we did a lot of positive kind of things, I think. One of the things that people tend to forget a little bit about was we did the Check 21 bill, which allowed for the imaging of checks at its inception. Saved the government. I didn't realize this until after 9/11. After 9/11, there were 4 days where no airplanes flew. But what happened, the Fed had the obligation to fly canceled checks from one federal bank to another. I didn't even know that. And the Fed, you can imagine Alan Greenspan flying, you know, in a biplane, you know, with a scarf flying. That's basically what it was. So for 4 days, all these checks piled up. So NCR and Dayton had developed this technology that they could image checks, and you wouldn't have to fly these canceled checks around. And we introduced the bill, and we passed it in about 6 months or something. And it's, again, saved banks millions and millions of dollars and their customers because it's a lot more efficient system. It's true that you can't kite checks as effectively as you had to, but hey, it's against the law anyway. So it worked very well, and we passed on a large bipartisan majority. So we had some innovative kind of things like decimals and that kind of made the system more efficient, less or more cost effective, and we did it on a bipartisan basis. And that gave me a lot of pride.
Do you think that things have gotten more partisan over the last
few
years?
Clearly they have. I feel for Spencer Bacus because it's just a wholly different atmosphere now. And that's a shame, I think, because the committee really did, I think, turn the corner when I was there. And I'm proud of the fact that I took a committee that was the old banking committee, that some describe as kind of a sleepy committee, and with that jurisdiction and with bipartisan cooperation, made it into a powerhouse committee that is now a exclusive committee, one of only four exclusive committees in the House. Mm-hmm. So we leave a great legacy, and it's unfortunate, I think, that Spencer has to deal with that partisanship, which was basically not the case when I was chairman. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, since 2007, you've been working as a senior advisor to the NASDAQ in your capacity here at Baker Hostetler. Would you mind telling me just a little bit about what you've been up to the last couple of years?
Well, Baker Hostetler is a fine Cleveland, Ohio firm, started in Cleveland. Our main office is still in Cleveland. I've known several of the attorneys here over the years and felt it was a good place. Guy Vanderjack, who had been on the Ways and Means Committee in the House and chairman of the Republican Campaign Committee for years, when he retired from Congress, he came here. So, and I had a lot of respect for Guy, and so it just seemed a natural fit. So I'm of counsel here. So I do everything from Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, white collar kind of thing, to banking issues, Fed issues, that kind of thing. We help companies deal with SOX requirements, that kind of thing. And then with NASDAQ, I'm a senior advisor to the board, which is kind of a broad. I do some speaking for NASDAQ, occasionally do a little lobbying for them. That's pretty much what I do. And then for the first 2 years, I gave a lot of speeches all over the world. Sarbanes and I together gave speeches or presentations in Hong Kong, Mumbai, Orlando, Chicago, Moscow.
Quite the world tour.
All over the globe, yeah. It was fascinating. So
sure.
Now that's kind of receded. It's kind of old news now. But I still do occasional speeches. I went to Kazakhstan last year and gave a speech. So,
I think there's a few people around the world who are still interested in talking about Sarbanes-Oxley and all.
Well, maybe. I will see.
Well, Congressman, did you have any final thoughts or stories that you'd like to share with us?
Well, we had Paul Sarbanes and I had a chance to speak on a number of occasions together all over the globe, from Hong Kong to Mumbai to Moscow to Chicago to Orlando, and we kind of developed a little bit of a Martin Lewis kind of a shtick, and we would tell stories about the bill and how it developed and so forth. And one of my stories was I always tell people I got a new first name, and it's Sarbanes, and so Sarbanes would say he would go back to Maryland. They couldn't understand how his last name became hyphenated So I tell the story about when my secretary called one time, and she said, Senator Sarbanes is on 9-2. So I pick it up, and there's a voice on the other end, and said, this is your first name. So that, anyway, so I went to Davos to the World Economic Forum in this winter of 2002. And I was on a couple of panels or something. Anyway, we had a reception one night that was put on by one of the accounting firms, I think. Anyway, I was there, and we were having a drink before the dinner, and I had my name tag on. And this, I was talking to a couple of people, and this guy was kind of hanging around, and he came up to me, finally staring at my name tag. He was a little short guy, I think he was from Singapore. And he said, I want to meet Sarbanes-Oxley. I want to shake hands with Sarbanes-Oxley. And I said, well, I can do that. I said, well, how come you want to shake hands with Sarbanes-Oxley? He said, I never got a chance to shake hands with Glass-Steagall. Honest to God.
Oh, that's
unbelievable.
Nice.
So Sarbanes is telling the story about how he had this hearing on accounting principles and in the committee, and three panels on accounting principles, dry as dust. So he says about the third panel, it had pretty well winnowed out. There were only a couple members around. And these guys, were the witnesses were droning on. And one of the senators didn't realize his microphone was live. And he kind of leans back and says, this is the most boring hearing I've ever been involved with. At which time, Mike Enzi from Wyoming, who was a freshman senator and the only CPA in the Senate, Mike Enzi was hears this, and he turns his mic on, and he says, I beg your pardon. He says, this is the most exciting time I've had since I've been in the U.S. Senate. So it depends on, you know, where you're coming from. So anyway, we had all kinds of stories to tell, but that was a lot of fun.
Okay, great. Well, Congressman, we really appreciate you being with us today and taking some time to talk with us.
All right, my pleasure, Jay.